Yo, what's up, guys? It's JB here. Today is Monday, the 28th of November, 2011. Happy Thanksgiving to everyone watching this. I hope everyone had an awesome holiday weekend with your family and ate a lot of turkey and is ready for an amazing podcast today. We are joined on this podcast by someone very special, someone I'm very close friends with, and I'm honored to have joining us on this. Every time we do one of these roundtable discussion podcasts, we take questions directly from you guys, directly from our members in the forum. And we get to as many questions as we possibly can within a finite amount of time on these podcasts. Today, we're joined by someone that performs every week at the Waldorf Astoria in New York City. It's one of the nicest hotels that exists in the world, and it's certainly one of the nicest magic venues that anyone could dream of or ask for. And the guy that's on the line with me right now has been performing there for over 10 years now, every single week, to sold-out audiences that sell out weeks in advance or months in advance. And his name is Steve Cohen. Steve, are you on the line? Can you hear me okay right now?
I can hear you just fine. Thanks so
Great.
much.
So thank you for doing this. And on behalf of all of our members, I'm sure they're very thankful for the opportunity to pick the brain of someone like you who has not only seen so much success in magic, but has a lot of expertise and knowledge that can be offered to people that are young and new and want to make a career out of magic themselves.
Yeah, that's great. I'm really looking forward to this, this roundtable. I think I was able to screen a bunch of the questions beforehand, and I think there's some terrific questions that your members have asked. So
There's
let's get to it.
great questions. Yeah, we have over, I think it's 160 to 175 plus questions. We're going to get to all of them. No, I'm just kidding. We're not going to get.
We'll have to just use every other word.
This will be a 12-hour podcast. You guys better
Exactly.
get comfortable and sit tight. No, we're going to get to as many as we can, and I kind of want to get started right now if we can, if that's okay with you, Steve, so we can get to as much as possible.
I'm all set. Let's go for it.
Great. So the first question I want to start with is a good kickoff question. It's post number 10 from a member named Centurion, and he says, "How did you get into magic?"
Well, this is a question that most magicians, if you ever are interviewed as a magician, this will be the first question you're always asked: "How did you get involved in magic?" And over the course of time, you'll probably have a set answer, which I'm happy to give you my set answer. But it always nice when, and this is a little bit of advice, when people ask you how did you get involved in magic, you have to kind of just make it seem fresh, like you're not telling the story for the thousandth time, because people really want to know. It's not common to meet a magician. Most people don't meet magicians. We hang out with other magicians and spend time within our community of magicians, but when a non-magician meets a magician, it's really kind of a special occasion for them. So having an answer that's not a joke answer, and having a genuine answer is actually a pretty good thing to work on. My answer is that my uncle was an amateur magician, and he was born in 1901. When he was a boy, he actually saw and met Houdini, and was inspired to learn magic himself, and he actually got a book by Professor Hoffman. The book called Magic with Cards. It's now I actually have that book. He passed it on to me, and that book inspired me. And my uncle just taught me the tricks that he had learned, and I just kept on practicing from there. I grew up in Westchester County, New York, which is about an hour north of Manhattan, in New York. And the chances to come into the city were pretty high. My dad used to drive us down to the city pretty regularly as a family, and I would always go to Tannen's Magic Shop and buy the latest trick or some little books or booklets, lecture notes and whatnot, things that were available, things that the pitchman would show me from behind the counter. And then later on, growing up, I went to Tannen's Magic Camp, which was a great opportunity. Got a chance to meet some great counselors who were professional magicians, and also other fellow campers who were really talented young magicians, like myself at the time, a teenage magician. And we were able to bounce ideas off of each other and create some of our own tricks as well. So that's pretty much how I got into it. It was my uncle, and then going down to Tannen's and going to Tannen's Magic Camp.
That's awesome. I remember when I was a kid and coming to New York for the first time, I remember being in the hotel. I don't remember what hotel my family was staying at. I was very young, and I looked in the phone book because phone books still existed then. And I saw that there was a magic shop in New York, and it was called Tannen's, and I'd never heard of it. And I remember walking many, many blocks. It felt like forever because I was a little kid. And I went to Tannen's, and I went up in the elevator. This was, might not be the same location they were at when you were a kid.
Yeah, I was at 1540 Broadway. So that's actually turned into a big office building now.
Wow.
Probably the one you're at was in Midtown,
Yep.
34th, 32nd Street.
Yep. And I remember
Right.
the elevator doors opening. And I'm like, wow, magic shops, these exist. This is amazing. And
Right.
I
No,
was
it really, it was an extraordinary place, and You know, I used to get, you talked about, you know, the phone book still existed. I used to get the Tannen's catalog, which was a printed big fat book. I mean, like the size of a dictionary, really. That was really like a dream book or a wish list or wish book. Yeah, I remember the Sears catalog way back when. I don't know if you're old enough to remember that Sears used to print out this very thick catalog of all the items that people would ever want to buy for, you know, for holidays, for the holiday presents. And there was a magic version of that, which was the Tannen's catalog. Abbott's had one, and Hank Lee had one. All the big dealers that we know today, before they had websites, they had to print out an annual catalog of everything that they were selling. So those catalogs with all the Ed Michelle illustrations were just so enticing. And, you know, I would look at these pictures and try to figure out how the tricks were done and read the descriptions, and it always say, you know, the same types of dealer caliber, dealer talk that we hear today on the web pages, saying, you know, no wires, no strings, no trapdoors, no sleeves, you can do this in your birthday suit, you know. And but, you know, it was just almost like a puzzle that you try to figure out how each trick was done.
And keep in mind, so, people listening to this, you never got to see the trick. You were going off of a written explanation of how it looked, and you had to take their word for it that it looks the same before
it arrives. Plus, there was also the JB. There were also illustrations. There were no photographs. they were all hand drawn pictures. So, you know, for example, a Toppet vanisher, and we all know what a Toppet is, right? With the, you know, the secret pocket in her jacket. There would be a picture of a man there holding something in his hand, right? Like, let's say, like an alarm clock or something. And then the next picture would have the man holding his hands open with, like, this flash of lightning in between his hands, as if something had vanished, you know? And so in your mind, you have to think, oh, wow, you know, something vanished in between picture A and picture B in this illustration. And I don't know how it could be done. It must be the Toppet vanisher. I must have one. You know, so again, this is way before YouTube, way before, you know, they had photographs and catalogs. It was all hand-drawn illustrations, and that was how it really enticed me. And it kind of made, you know, it's different from people who are buying magic today. It made me really think about, you know, what could magic look like in your head?
That's awesome. Let's skip ahead many, many years. Second question, post number 48, is asking, how did you get the opportunity to perform at the Waldorf Astoria? So obviously this came at least a few years after your experience at Tannen's.
Many
but,
years later.
But what is how did that opportunity come about?
Right, so working at the Waldorf Astoria has really turned into a dream come true for me. I mean, a real dream come true, because when I was a boy, I always dreamed of performing in Manhattan, and I always dreamed of performing in kind of a fancy upscale venue. That was just a dream of mine, especially those catalog descriptions. It always made it seem like magic should be performed in a fancy place. And so I started doing the show first in my friend's apartment when I was in my late 20s, when I was 29 years old exactly. I'm 40 now. And when I was doing the show at my friend's apartment, I would just invite some of my customers and friends over to do a parlor-style show, almost like a showcase. And the shows were very well received. They were not money makers. They were really just to do them to get some practice.
You charged the admission, though?
We did charge admission, but then I had, you know, expenses and whatnot. So it all pretty much was a wash. But I wasn't really doing it for the money at all. I was just really doing it to as a prototype, to see if the show would, if this type of a show would work in a venue in that style room. And so the answer was yes. And then I started scouting. Everything that I've done really has been very proactive. I started scouting venues in New York City. And I know from experience that there are a lot of private clubs in Manhattan. So I approached a few private clubs. I became a member of the National Arts Club in Gramercy Park. And then started doing the show at their clubhouse, which is in Gramercy Park South in Manhattan. It's right, right next to the Players Club, which is where the John Mulholland collection, the library, used to be housed.
Houdini collection.
So, yeah, it's a very valuable and well-known collection. I think that
David Copperfield.
That's David Copperfield.
Yes.
So I started doing the show at this clubhouse, the National Arts Club. The problem was that after 3 months, they said, you can't keep on doing the show here. We want to use this room for other things. And, you know, we kind of gave you your little run, and we have to move on to other things. So I realized there was some momentum I had built up, but I didn't want to just stop it there because the venue said no. So the very last show that I did there, I appealed to the audience. This is my last show here at the National Arts Club. If there's anyone in the room who happens to know of another venue, I'm all ears. I'm looking for a new spot. And just by chance, there was an executive there from the Waldorf Astoria who heard my plea, and invited me up to see one of their rooms there, and it was just a knockout. It was the royal suite of the Waldorf Astoria, where the Duke and Duchess of Windsor used to live, top floor, 42nd floor. Room rents for $10,000 a night. And they said, you can do your show here. And I said, hold on, I can do a show here? Can I do more than one show here? They said, well, it'll be your room. You can use it for, you know, however many shows you want to do a night. And I said, well, how about two or three? They said, sure. If you'd like to do two or three shows, that's your choice. You'll have the room. You can sleep there. It's a you know, 4,000 square foot apartment, basically. And suddenly, I just saw this incredible vista ahead of me. I realized that if this works the way I envision it, I could make this run forever. This could be a show that I run forever. And that's actually what's happened. To make a very long story short, 9/11 happened right after I started working there, within a month after my show started at the Waldorf. So I realized that if I wanted to keep the show running, I had to do something to keep this show up and running, which wouldn't be a moneymaker again. I invited all the Red Cross workers from 9/11, from downtown at Ground Zero, to come up and see the show for free. So I had every week I was doing a show there, I had, you know, about two-thirds of the audience were just volunteers for the Red Cross. And I kept the show running for about 2 months or so. Again, this is all out of my own pocket, doing the show for volunteers. And again, I just kept the momentum going because I needed to keep the show going. I realized that if you wanted to have a long-term business, you can't just do it once in a while. It has to be something regular that people always hear about and know about. You know, I wanted to make sure that the word got out. So these people who came to the show as comps, they walked out on, you know, they were seeing awful things during the day. At night, after the show was over, they were thrilled and delighted and elated. And they were my mouthpieces and helped spread the word.
That's great.
And then just over the course of time, you know, it appeared on television and you know, other media venues, and the show just kept on running now for the past 11 years.
Follow-up question that I thought would be interesting for people to know, because it sounds so simple when you say it like that. It sounds like yeah. You're just doing this show, and this person from the Waldorf was like, hey, what's up? You want to do a show for us in this amazing suite? But can you tell people, do you have any estimation of how many shows you had done at the National Arts Club before that, you know, overnight opportunity surfaced for itself?
Right. Well, you know, there's the answer to that question is that I've always been a marketer of magic as well as a magician. I am a diehard magician. If you ever corner me at a magic convention or see me sometime, I love to go move for move with you, or move to move, head to head, diagonal palm shifts and one-handed bottom palms, and you know, I love all the hardcore magic thought and you know, design that goes into the tricks. But I've always thought of magic also as a business, because when I was a kid doing magic shows in Westchester County, I was doing birthday parties and whatnot and bar mitzvah parties, performing at these events. I realized that if I wanted to buy the next book or prop, I had to actually have money to do that. And the only way I could really do that is by marketing my show. So, you know, the answer to your question is, how many shows did I do before I got that overnight opportunity? There never was that overnight opportunity. I've just been plugging away constantly, like a real road warrior, trying just to, you know, make sure that each show is the best I can possibly give. But I always think of each show as an infomercial for my business. So, you know, at the end of the show, not only that, I don't just end the show. I say, if you enjoyed yourselves, please take one of the postcards out by the front door. You'll find that there's a website and information about the show, and this way you can help tell your friends and family about it. We don't advertise this anyplace. It's really thanks to people like you that this show's been running so long. And, you know, giving a little bit of a sales pitch for about, I don't know, how long did that take, 20 seconds? Mm-hmm. It just plants in people's minds the idea of spreading the word for you. And so, you know, I'm not ashamed to do that at all, because clearly it's working.
Oh, you don't pay for, you don't see Steve Cohen billboards in New York City.
Yeah, I don't have to advertise. I don't advertise anywhere, but it's all run through word of mouth, which means two things. It means that people have to like what you do, and you have to be doing something extraordinary, and you have to be doing it regularly. So, you know, a lot of I get emails from people often, from magicians, asking, how can I set up a show like yours at a hotel? Or how can I make a business like yours where you're making, you know, seven-figure? How is that possible? And, you know, the answer is not call up a hotel and say, hey, I want to do a show every week at your hotel, because that's just not going to happen, I can tell you right now. it's a matter of finding a venue where you can work regularly and just keep at it. You have to keep the show going so that people hear about it. Maybe that's a restaurant for you. Maybe that's doing a regular venue at a lounge somewhere. I don't perform on the street, obviously, unless it's Park Avenue, or Wall Street. I'm the 1% magician. So you have to find a venue where people know you there. They could find you. One of the things I find from magicians is they'll say to me, I want to do a show once a month at this hotel. Can you help me with it? Can you tell me an idea of how I can market the show, or how can I get the hotel to sign on? And the answer is, you've already shot yourself in the foot. It can't be every once in a while. Once in a month is just too scarce. It has to be really regular. I'm doing 5 shows a week, 2 shows on Friday, 3 shows on Saturday. And I even do a 6th show on some weeks, a midnight show. And the reason I do this is well, first of all, because people bought tickets, but second of all, because people need to know that you're there, that you'll be there whether or not they're there. They'll know that you're regularly there, that you're consistent. You're consistently in a location, that they could find you. And unless they could find you, they're not going to buy a ticket to see you or to buy your services as a performer. So you have to be visible, top of mind, and just out there. And that's one way to do it.
That's awesome. I think you just answered post number 36 asking about advice for people starting in a magic career as well. So I'm going to skip ahead a few so we can get to a few more questions.
I'm not looking at the questions here. I'm just riffing. So
okay, cool.
I'm not looking at your list of questions. Although the questions that everyone offered are great.
Amazing. So post number 17, William McKeenan asks about nerves. Do you get nervous? You've done these shows for over 10 years now at the Waldorf, many more before that. Do you still get nervous? Is there any anxiety before you walk on that stage every night still?
You know something? There's a good answer to that, which is that I think every performer should have some degree of nervousness before you go out. And even if you've done the show thousands of times, like I've done this 3,000 or 4,000 times, you know, if you're not nervous before you go out there, then there's something wrong. It means that you're not fully in the game. It's a human natural response to be a little bit nervous. And in fact, the most nervous I've been was when I knew that Woody Allen was going to be in the audience in the front row. He was there with his wife and 2 daughters. And I have been a Woody Allen fan my entire life. So knowing that Woody Allen was going to be sitting in the front row and walking out and seeing him there, I actually had cotton balls in my mouth. But that's never happened before. It was pretty amazing. Like I realized that my body was just like freezing up. But he actually loved the show and was clapping and laughing like everyone else, which was really a thrill. But how do you deal with the nerves? The way I deal with the nerves is I think to myself, even if I'm performing for someone wealthy or someone who's famous, that they've never seen me before, and I've got something special to offer them. So not being cocky about it, but just knowing I've got something which I can share that will make this person happy and make this person thrilled, and when they walk away from having been with me, that they'll have, you know, experienced a better day than if they hadn't met me. So that actually gives me kind of an upper hand rather than being a subservient performer where you're, you know, kind of deigning to someone's request of saying, you know, if it'll prevail upon you to stand over here. You're a commanding person as a performer, as a magician. A magician is a powerful character. I mean, think of any wizard, the portrayal of a wizard in a movie. You know, you never see a wizard who's a bumbler or someone who's weak. You don't often see weak wizards. You know, it's a powerful position, a powerful character. So, you know, if you can kind of channel that or funnel that nervousness into your performing persona, you could actually make it into, you could flip it and make it into, you know, an amplification of your nerves.
A follow-up question to that, talking about nerves. People are nervous when they go out on stage because you're afraid of what? You're afraid if you mess up or if something doesn't go to plan, especially if you're in front of Warren Buffett or Woody Allen. This question is post number 52 by Salsa, and he's asking, what do you do when you mess up a trick in a live performance? Surely doing this for 10 years, things don't always go right. The audience might have an effect on that. The cards might slip. What do you do when you mess up, or how do you, as a performer doing this so often, plan ahead for those sorts of circumstances?
Or something falls out of your sleeve, like it just happened to me the other day. These things happen. I mean, the best answer to that is if you're a musician, if let's say that you play in a jazz band or some sort of an ensemble, you know, if you fumble with your music, you can't stop and look at the audience and have them look back at you and say, "Oops," you just keep going with it. And you know, the rhythm is also is really the most important thing, because if the audience perceives that there's a speed bump, you're in trouble. The real key is to assume the audience didn't see anything, or if they did to see something, that they don't really know what your outcome is. And that's the beauty of magic, is that there's always, the ending should be a surprise, unless you've set yourself up, you know, by creating some conditions. But most of the time, the outcome is going to be a surprise to the audience. So I often have different paths that I can take, or different routes, different endings. I learned about that, the concept of having different outs, or plan B, plan C, etc., from a great, I was going to say beginner book, but it's not really a beginner book in magic, called Outs, Precautions, and Challenges, that I remember owning many years ago. It's probably somewhere in my library now. But Outs, Precautions, and Challenges is all about, you know, what do you do if something goes wrong? And I recommend this book to a lot of young magicians who may not have ever heard of it, because even though the book is a little bit dated, it gives you the thought process of knowing that there are different ways of getting, or weaseling your way out of a situation while not breaking a sweat. And at the end, you may think to yourself, "Oh, that wasn't the way it's supposed to work," but the audience doesn't know that. And my other response to it is, every audience experiences your show in their own way. And by that, I mean, let's say at the end of a show, I think, "Oh boy, that show didn't go that well." People come up to me and they say, "That was one of the best shows I've ever seen in my life." And I think to myself, how is it possible that you thought that was one of the best shows? I thought it was one of my worst ever. And the answer is that they experienced and they enjoyed the show in their own way. And, you know, you can't take that away from someone. The gestalt of that audience is something that can never be recreated. And so, you know, that group of people enjoyed it maybe quieter than the audience before. Or the next group of people is going to just go berserk and they're going to give you a standing ovation. Or the next group might be you know, a little bit rowdy, and or abrasive even. And, you know, you can't control that. You can't control exactly how the audience will respond, but you have to respect that. And they may have enjoyed it, again, in their own way.
There's two more questions that I want to get to before we have to wrap this up, because I know you have to go.
I'm preparing for a couple of actually, you know, I should tell you, people often ask me how I spend my weeks, you know, because I do the shows on the weekend. I'm here at the Waldorf Astoria right now preparing, actually, for, and this is Monday, I'm preparing for my Friday and Saturday shows now. I prepare everything.
Yourself.
A week out, another week before the show. So if I have to set cards, if I have to set anything with my teapot, for the magic teapot, the any drink called for, think a drink. These are all things I like to prepare throughout the week. And there was a great magician who unfortunately just passed away recently named David Alexander. He's a wonderful, very bright magician, and magical historian. And he passed away just from a kind of a fluke accident in his home, in a rental home he owns. He once wrote to me, "Many magicians have a wrong perception of you." And I said, and I wrote back to him and said, "What do you mean by that?" He said, "They think that you just work 2 days a week, but I know that you're probably working a 50 or 60 hour week just preparing for those five shows." And I wrote back to him saying, "You are one of the wisest men I've ever met." Because, you know, I have to prepare so much in advance, and I'm willing to spend 50 or 60 hours to prepare for some shows that are going to be, you know, later in the week, because I think it's worth it. People deserve it. The audience deserves it. I can't walk in, and if people are spending a lot of money and hard-earned money, especially in this, you know, economy, people are spending, you know, hundreds or sometimes thousands of dollars to bring a group to come visit with me if they're buying out, you know, multiple seats. It's my responsibility to give them the best I can possibly give them, even if that requires a lot of behind-the-scenes work, whether that's magic practice, whether that's purchasing things that need to be used, whether that's refreshing props. You know, there's so much that has to be done behind the scenes. Sometimes when people hire me for a private event, I'll find out, for example, their favorite brand of pen. And let's say I'm doing a show for, you know, a wealthy guy in Boca Raton, let's say, which this happened, and he had this beautiful Cartier pen. I knew he had one. So I went out and bought the same Cartier pen. It was, you know, an expensive pen. And I went to his house and did the show for him. And right before I left, I said, "Oh, this is a beautiful pen." I picked it up from his desk, and I split it in two. I just, you know, I did a flipstick type of move, and I had the extra pen hidden in my hand. And I split his pen in two, and then just dropped both pens there on the desk and walked away and left them there. And he went bananas. He went berserk. And this is the kind of thing I'm talking about, you know, going to any length to really make an impression on your audience.
That's amazing. So it's not just about getting the gimmick or getting the props ready. It's about putting in the time, being willing to go the extra mile to get the result that you want from your audience. I feel like magicians can, it's very attractive to become lazy. And if the trick isn't entirely self-working, or if it doesn't just immediately come to you, or if it's a little bit expensive of a gimmick, the distinguishing factor is it worth it? Is it worth it? And the example you just gave of this duplicating this guy's pen that he has, as far as he's concerned, no one else knows he has, and you just doubled it magically. That's something he's going to talk about for the next decade of his life, if not more than that. And you know, it took you a little bit of foresight and an investment to make, but it's comes down to the question of how far you're willing to go and how much you're willing to work to be successful.
And I'm talking about $1,000 pen, you know. So this is like, you know, it was not a cheap trick, but it's one that was worth it in the long run, because it's something that people will talk about forever.
He's going to tell his friends, and judging by the fact that you said he lives in Boca Raton and probably is a guy that brought you in, he probably has friends in high places.
Exactly.
So this is a good question.
Well, maybe we could do like two or three more questions.
Sure. So here is one I thought I wanted to definitely get to somehow in this podcast. What do you think, it says, is the hardest thing about your choice in career? What is the most difficult thing? And to follow this up, and this is related to that question, Decisive Ambivalence, post number 24, says, are there any times when you lose your passion for magic? You're performing so often. You're doing 10 shows a week sometimes, 6 shows a week other times. Do you ever get worn out? Do you ever get tired? Do you ever feel so burnt out that you lose some of that fire and passion that you obviously have? And what do you do when you feel that coming on? How do you stop that and keep yourself moving forward with so much momentum?
Right. Well, I'll answer the second question first. The second question is about keeping the passion for something, for magic. You know, when you do the same show over and over again, and like I do is a set show, it's easy to just go into overdrive and just think, I can continue this show without really thinking. My head doesn't have to be in the game. I've done this thousands of times. But that's the biggest kiss of death, you know, for a performer. You have to be, it has to be fresh. It has to appear fresh to the audience, as if you're saying these lines for the very first time. And, you know, the intonation of your voice even has to sound as if these are not recited lines. You know, you often hear people, performers and comedians even, they're reciting lines, and they don't sound like their regular intonation or articulation of those words. They you know what I mean? They're kind of just a, they're almost like, I don't know the right word for this, just they're acting their words out as opposed to really speaking them. Well, you know, this, it really does come down to acting in a way. You know, I used to be in the theater all through high school and college when I went to Cornell. And you know, we would do productions where we would do, let's say, 2 shows or 3 shows a weekend. One show on Friday, and then maybe a Saturday matinee and a Saturday evening show. And I learned that, you know, you have to always bring yourself back to ground zero, back to your point where you're just starting as if you haven't done a show yet. And I'll do, for example, you know, 5 shows, 6 shows. I've done 10 shows in a weekend. I always think to myself, this is the first one. I tricked myself in a way, almost like, you know, it's a mental game as opposed to a physical game. I tricked myself into thinking, this is my first show of the weekend, even if it's my last. And the moment you think this is my first show, then you kind of, your brain tricks your body into thinking, get some energy up here, folks. You know, get yourself ready for this. This is exciting. You know, you haven't done a show yet. So it's really kind of a mental game to trick yourself into thinking, this is my first time doing this. And after you start tricking yourself, then it actually does feel like it's your first time doing it, and that's where you can start to play. And that, for me, is the fun part. I haven't really talked about this before much. But, you know, once you become so familiar with your material, then you can go off script, and you can really interact and listen to the audience. You can really hear what they're saying. And if someone says something funny, you can incorporate and say it something back as an ad-lib. Just the other night, there was a show at the Waldorf I did. There was a kid there. I say a kid. He was probably like 22 years old or so. 22-year-old guy.
Me, great.
Yeah, who had red hair. Okay, so I looked at him and I said, young man with the auburn hair, will you please take the deck of cards and look at a card? And he said to me, can I think of any card? And I said, yes. He goes, can I think of an Auburn card? And I said, yes, you can think of an Auburn card as opposed to a black card. Yes, there's Auburn and black cards in this deck. Look at an Auburn card. Because he was just playing off the fact that I just said something about his hair color, you know. And I just thought that was funny. And you know, if you've never gone off script before, it's scary. You know, if you're doing a scripted show and someone says something that breaks your script, then you're in trouble. But if you become familiar with your material, it's become second nature to you. You've done it so many times. You can play with it. The magic becomes so much more fun that way. You don't really lose the passion because you realize each show can change up a little bit. And that, you know, it's kind of like Andy Kaufman, the old comedian. He used to antagonize his audiences. And he would antagonize them because their responses were his entertainment. He was actually provoking them to get angry at him. And then he would actually laugh to himself at how their responses were so aggressive towards him. And in a way, I feel that that's kind of happened with me, where I'm not trying to antagonize anyone by any means. But the audience's reactions are funny for me. Sometimes I'll laugh at things that people say. And you know, when you can respond to the audience, they realize that you're there with them as opposed to performing at them. So that's answer number one. Answer number two was, what was the question again? It was about what would you do?
How difficult is it to
be a magician, right? What's the hardest thing about being a magician? The hardest part is that people often don't take magician as a career choice seriously. So if I say to if someone says at a cocktail party, and I'm at a party with some hedge fund managers and some bankers and some doctors and some attorneys and whatnot, and they'll say, oh, where do you work? And I say, well, I work at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. Oh, really? What do you do? I'm a magician. And then they go, oh, you're a magician. I don't get it. You know, my children had a magician at their birthday party. You know, little do they know that, you know, I'm performing at birthday parties, but they're for billionaires on private islands, and they fly me down on private jets. So it's a different type of a response than people would expect. And, you know, I personally think that being a magician should not be although it's admittedly a quirky career choice, I don't think it should be one that you're ever embarrassed of. Be proud of being a magician. Being a magician is exciting. It's unique. It's, you know, it's a career choice that that people will always ask questions about. You'll never be at a loss. If someone asks you, you know, what are you doing? You say, I'm a magician. You automatically got a conversation, you know, a starter. And then often people will want to see a trick. But, you know, don't force it on people. If you force it on people, it's like Max Mullaney, my hero. He wouldn't perform magic unless he was being paid. And, you know, in many ways, I kind of take that to heart. I don't do performances for people just by, you know, if I meet people at a party, it's like a dentist. You know, someone will always say, oh, you know, I have this problem with my molar or my wisdom teeth. You know, you're at a party. You don't want to be, you know, bombarded with that kind of question if you're a dentist. As a magician, people always expect you to do something. You don't have to, but you can talk about it. And even if you just talk about it, people will find that fascinating. You know, convincing my wife and my wife's parents, my in-laws, that the marrying a magician was okay. That was probably one of my biggest tricks. Because, you know, think about it. You know, it's like, oh, I'm going to get married, my wife says. You know, I'm getting married to a magician. You know, it's just one of the oddest things that a parent could ever think that their daughter's going to do. But in our case, you know, they say magicians' wives don't like magic. In our case, it's different. My wife likes my magic. She just hates me. Magic is the only thing keeping our marriage together.
I like the point that you said about making each performance as if it's your first, because if you think about it, it is the first time you've performed ever for that audience, and for the rest of, you know, you have to go into it thinking that that audience maybe won't return to New York for a decade or 5 years. It might be a random trip that they're taking. So for the rest of the year, for the rest of the decade, for the rest of their life, this is your one opportunity, your one chance to show them who Steve Cohen is and who you are.
Correct. By the way, and people don't wear signs on their shirt saying, you know, I can hire you. You know, the reason I set up that show at the Waldorf is actually a different reason than I'm doing it now. When I first started it, it was as a showcase so that people could hire me for private events. I knew that people would call me up. I would get calls, you know, from someone who had seen me or someone who had heard about me. This is before the Waldorf, okay? I was in my early mid-20s, moving back from Tokyo, Japan, living in New York, young couple with my wife, no kids. I would get calls, and people would say, well, okay, so I heard you're good, but how much do you charge? And I would say whatever it was, and then they would say, well, how do I know you're any good? And I said, well, you have to just take my word for it. Or here's a reference you can call. and this is before websites. You know, people, magicians didn't have websites then. So, you know, I lose a lot of gigs that way because my prices were a little bit higher than some of my competitors. And I realized that if I wanted to get work, I had to have a showcase where people could see me. And that was the whole, that was the impetus. That was like the sole purpose of setting up these public shows, was that people could come in, see me, and then say, you know, I really liked what you did. I saw your act now. Now I want to hire you to perform at our law firm's, you know, summer outing. Or now I want you to perform at our event, you know, in Palm Springs. Or now I want you to perform at our event in Honolulu or whatever. You know, people don't want to make the plunge until they've seen it themselves. It's like, you know, how many times have you bought something sight unseen? You know, that's a high ticket item? Very rarely. You really want to, you have to get the social verification. You know, people who buy this kind of thing have said it's great. You need to see it yourself or have someone who's seen it tell you it's great. But always the magic, people want to see it first. So having that showcase was critical for me. You know, like I said, in the beginning, I was losing money. I was just pumping my own money into this show. It was not a money-making venture. It was purely just like, it was like a form of advertising. Now, the tables have turned almost entirely, where I'm performing, you know, 5 to 6 shows a week, and they're like you mentioned earlier, they're sold out, you know, months ahead of time. And I believe I'm the luckiest guy in the world to be able to say that. But I'm doing fewer private shows because my prices are just so high. You know, it's kind of ridiculous. I remember talking to my friend Darren Brown about this. Darren said, you know, the moment I became a television personality, I just increased my prices and people would still pay them. So now it's the same thing for me. You know, I've got people who come to see me at the Waldorf. I've kind of created this paradigm shift that, you know, magic is now more highly perceived as a commodity that's more valuable because they've seen it in this gorgeous setting. And they've seen a killer show that everyone's walking out saying, that was, you know, one of the best shows I've ever seen. And they say, okay, I'm willing to pay for this now. And so I can raise my prices, and I have raised my prices, and people still buy it. They still buy my private shows because they've seen it.
They've seen it, and it's very limited. You know, it's a very small venue. It's not like there are thousands of people at each of your shows. It's how many? It's 75, 100 people, or is it less at each?
Yeah, I do 50. Yeah, for the Waldorf show, it's between 50 and 60 people per show.
So it's a very limited thing, and it's kind of like a viral video. Once these people see it themselves, they want to share it with their friends. It's not advertised anywhere. It just virally spreads itself through word of mouth.
Exactly. And by the way, I hate to cut you off. I've got, you know, on a daily basis, I'm selling, you know, 50 to 100 tickets daily, every single day throughout the year. And that's why we're able to, you know, have the show sold out in advance because, you know, people go to the website where the ticket sales are and they'll see that the calendar is full and sold out, you know, for a month or so ahead of time. And then they'll pick a date down the line. So it kind of, the pipeline is always full. And I always dreamed of this, and so it's kind of come true. It's exciting to have a dream kind of like that come true, when you've formulated a business model and it has played out the way I planned it, even better than I planned it. But you know, I always like to break things down, and I always never take anything for granted either. So, for instance, if you have a goal of making $1 million in a year, how many tickets do you have to sell, or how many shows do you have to do to you know, be able to make that number, to make that nut? And then you have to do a division problem. It's a simple division problem. I want to do, you know, I want to do 10 shows. Okay, so you have to charge $100,000 a show. How many people are going to pay you $100,000 to do a show? Okay, so I can't do 10 shows. I have to do more. And just break it down like this and keep dividing it until it becomes a number that's rational for you and rational for your market.
This is a great question for us to close this with and end this with, because I know you have to run, is by Ed Bull, is his name, post number 37. And his post says, what do you ultimately want to become? So you've had so much success so far. You started off as a kid in Tannins, you know, based on your uncle showing you these tricks when you were very young. You've graduated from private events to what I see as the Ivy League of magic, which is, you know, it's up there with the greatest performance venues you could possibly ask for. It's the Waldorf Astoria. How do you top that? What is the next step? You're still, you're older than me, but you're still young. So what is the next chapter in the Steve Cohen book, or what are your remaining goals of what you want to accomplish next?
Thanks for asking. That's a good question. Question that was from who was that question from?
Ed
That was
Bull
from
is his name. 3D Bull.
3D Bull. 3D Bull. Nice question. If your name is 3D Bull listening right now, thank you. That's a good question to end on. I'm actually planning a show, which is a new show, which is a stage performance. Now, I'm used to doing parlor shows in the Hofzinser style, in Robert Houdin style, and Charles Bertram style of, you know, of days gone by in the 19th century. But the next stage for me, the next step for me really is a stage show, and I'm debuting the show at Carnegie Hall here in New York City. That's right, the famous Carnegie Hall. The closest I ever got was Carnegie Deli, so very excited about this.
We went there after the Letterman show, remember?
We did go there after the Letterman show, that's right. They give you a pastrami sandwich and they say, make this disappear. I'm working now on this stage show, and I work in collaboration with my best friend and partner, Mark Levy, and we've created this stage show, which is now for audiences of 300 to 500 people. And my plan is to take the show on the road, and in each city I perform in, I'll be doing the stage show and the parlor show, Chamber Magic show, you know, both at a large theater and also at smaller venues in upscale five-star hotels. So that's the next step. I'm also working on a TV show, which I can't give too many details on, but I have a contract for a big a two-hour pilot, which I'll be working on in the spring right after the Carnegie Hall show is over. And that's pretty much it for now. But those are two very, very large projects, and I can't wait to get involved.
It's amazing. I think there's a lot people listening to this can learn from you, both from, it's just, to me, you represent the kind of the perfect storm mixture of business, things people can learn from you about business, about branding, about style. Obviously, not your style doesn't represent everyone's style, but you've certainly developed your own style and your own niche and your own tagline and all of these things that are not accidents. These are very calculated, brilliant marketing efforts, and making up the content of your show and where you perform, all of these things that are working together to formulate who you are and why your show works. So on a lot of levels, I think there's so much people listening to this can learn from you by studying what you've done and what you continue to do. And then also the fact that you're actually a nice guy, and I can vouch for this, and you do care about magic, and you do, you know, last time we were at dinner, you're practicing a specific move that was referenced in an obscure book that you've been working on for 3 weeks. So it's not just about the tickets to you. It's about the art. It's about the, you know, the why it works, and always trying to improve and evolve and advance yourself. And I think all of that collectively is very inspiring, and it's what everyone listening to this should aspire to do themselves.
Thank you.
So on that note, thank you, Steve. Awesome podcast. I think we answered as many of the questions as we possibly can. If you guys have any specific questions that you'd like us to answer that we did not get to, of course, feel free to post them in the forums, or we'll do what we can to get Steve to answer. But thank you, Steve, for taking time out of your day today, out of your busy week and your holiday weekend to answer these questions for us. And thank you guys who were so prolific in submitting questions for us to ask. And the questions we got were amazing, and they definitely made for an amazing podcast. So thank you to everyone, and thank you to Steve. Once again,
My
and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.